Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Kia ora e te whānau, welcome to Country Life, I'm Duncan Smith.
Great to have your company, ko Sally Round Dene. Today we find out why bugs are the main theme at this year's Ashburton A&P show.
We revisit a garden where ropes and special tools act as eyes for Taranaki's inspirational Graham Mosen.
And we hear about the daily struggles and successes of a woman who farmed almost single-handedly when her husband was away during the Second World War.
But now to look at conditions on the land. The ground sodden on Northland farms after about 150 millimetres of rain earlier this week. Our contact says it's nigh on impossible to get tractors into paddocks to sow crops. At local spring fairs, cattle prices have peaked and it's hard work trying to sell sheep. Our contact says farmers are holding back from buying stock due to economic uncertainty and fears of drought. Mild spring weather with sufficient rainfall has been good for growth in Pukekohe. Our contact says the light supply of most vegetables should no longer be an issue.
A commercial blueberry grower in Waikato says there's another 2 months of harvesting to go in his tunnel houses. In the outdoor crop, flowering's all but finished, but the cool and moist conditions were not great for pollination. Harvesting gets underway in 7 weeks. Staff are busy planting new varieties, mowing and weeding and doing machine maintenance. A Bay of Plenty avocado grower says his orchard's in the middle of the pollination phase. As the bees buzz around doing their thing, staff are thinning 30 to 50% of the fruit-bearing flowers on trees. He says early avocados will be ripe for picking from late November onwards.
A farm consultant in Taranaki says pasture growth's doing well at around 70 kilos of dry matter per hectare each day, and lots of silage is being made. Mating's in full swing on dairy farms with good submission rates. It's been a beautiful warm spring in Titai Rāwhiti. There's plenty of moisture. The grass is starting to spring back. There have been some record-breaking docking results, though the trick will now be to ensure enough feed for all. It wouldn't take long to dry out with the windy conditions they've been having. Farmers are just starting to be able to get in to do that heavy rehab work on dams and tracks and ensure water systems are ready for summer. They're being advised to try and break open dams if they can't get in to dig out the silt, ensure animals have another water source, and let the dams dry out until you can fix them as stock could get stuck in the mud trying to drink.
Apple trees have just finished blooming in Hawke's Bay, and thinning will kick off in a couple of weeks. Stone fruit orchards are well into hand thinning. It's been a good spring, no significant hail or frost, warm with a lot of sun. A consultant says while there have been significant losses from this year's cyclone, they're seeing resilience among surviving apple and pear trees, despite the waterlogging and silt. The same can't be said for stone fruit and kiwi fruit, where it's now apparent whole blocks have completely died. It's still pretty saturated in some parts of Rangitike Manawa too. Pasture covers are generally good and are coping with peak feed demand at the moment. Docking results have been mixed.
It's been a stop-start spring in Wairarapa and the challenging season is not over yet. But the ground is drying out and finally heavy machinery can get onto the land. It's been an 18-month wait for one farmer to do the work needed. Dairy guys are flat out with mating and are a little happier with milk prices, while those in the lamb business are not that optimistic. Rural support is still very active out at the coast 8 months after Cyclone Gabrielle. In the vineyard, sprinklers have been on, keeping late spring frosts at bay. To the South Island now, Te Waipanamu. At Tapawera, in the Nelson region, the late chill of August has set hops up well for strong growth. Hop strings are in place and teams of workers are training the vigorous hop binds up the strings. A time-consuming task, but if done correctly, can give a superior yield at harvest and make the hop-picking equipment process the crop more efficiently. Grass growth in the area is also excellent, giving ewes and lambs every opportunity to gain weight. Some good sunshine would be nice.
The Marlborough Sounds has been feeling more cooler southerly winds than usual. The farmer we talked to says this week, though, a couple of brilliant hot days were welcomed by ewes with lambs at foot. Surplus ewe hoggets have been sent off the property to lighten the load, and cows and calves are doing well. Because of the wet summer and autumn, there's been significant Purina grass grub survival. The pest is consuming more grass than the livestock in some areas of the farm. It'll become dormant shortly, but is likely to have an impact on lamb growth rates. On the west coast, a farmer at Ross in South Westland has got a good feeling about the 23-24 season. His cows are in tip-top condition and milking well. In fact, production's up 7-8% on last year. There's plenty of feed around and paddocks are still firm under hoof, despite regular rainfall. Artificial insemination, or AI, is due to start next week, but other farmers in the district are well into it already, he says.
The last month has been frantic on our contact's Hororata farm in Canterbury, with fodder beet, kale, swedes, hybrid radish, spinach seed and maize being planted. Fertiliser spreading and spraying's been difficult with a lot of windy conditions. Irrigation's now on as soils dry and temperatures increase. Bulls have also arrived and are out doing their job with the dairy heifers. A sheep and beef farmer in South Otago says he's expecting 2023 to be the worst financial year in his 40 years of farming. Farm costs are up 15-17% and income is down 20%. Lamb prices are predicted to drop $2 a kilo on last year, and we all know about strong wool prices. He says if he could retire tomorrow, he would. On the bright side, there's plenty of feed around, and lambing and tailing finished up this week. Next up, the lambs will be drenched, and the last mob of heifers will be trucked to the works. AI is in full swing on a Matoura dairy farm in Southland. Cows are just past peak milk production. Currently, they're producing 2.3 kilograms milk solids per day, but this will drop when they get pregnant. New grass and crops are in the ground, but windy conditions are making life difficult for spray contractors. Our contact says the farmers he's talked to are holding back on spending until they know what policy changes will be made in the ag sector.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
Now to a story from our archives. Graham Mosen is an educator, a designer, a woodworker, a cyclist and a gardener, and an inspiration to many. And although Graham has lost his sight, he continues to do what he's always done. I popped into his Inglewood home a couple of years ago when he and his mates and wife Val Mosen were enjoying a warm spring morning.
Well, let me introduce you to my oldest friend. This is Brian. Brian and I started the Taranaki Environmental Education Trust back in the 1990s, and
quite a while back.
We've journeyed that path and all its stories ever since. But look, there's a sneaky little breeze. Let's wander up the hill.
Okay. Graham knew he was losing his vision 30 years ago, and he's adapted the property so he can, as he says, still exist in the landscape. Graham, I've heard that you have ropes that have helped you get to the letterbox.
Yeah. I used to have one from that door down to the letterbox, but because I've now started to learn how to use a cane properly, I've disbanded that one, and the ropes just start up here a bit. So
we've walked up to your home, and there's a big sign saying Taranaki Environment Centre, closed.
I should put there, by appointment only. It's lovely. What we did after 25 years was pass the baton on. And, it's a really nice feeling that the current baton holders have got it now operating under the guise of sustainabletaranaki.org. They're busy doing the dreams that Brian and I set in place.
We used to have education days for schools, kindergartens.
That's Val, Graham's wife.
Agriculture courses, but other centres have taken on that task. EnviroSchool started up, and the need for action here diminished. So it's back to the two of us.
Over here, Sally, I've got...
Graham shows me the tandem bike he rides while his mate Brian, in his 90s, gets behind the wheatgrass juicer, and Ray mans the home-built pizza oven. You were the original greenies of Taranaki, you men.
Well, today we can offer you a short green or a long black. We're just in the middle of digging a Coomera garden, so we could wander up there and introduce you to the Broad Fork.
The Broad Fork? I'll follow
you. The Broad Fork, yeah, the Yuba.
If you guys wander on, I'll help Brian get set.
Because we've been here this long, we've been milling trees. This is some of the furniture we've made.
Graham used to teach woodwork, and he still enjoys building stuff from wood milled from the property.
We'll go up through the woodshed and I can show Sally the some planks of wood we've milled. I'm actually a genetic mutation. I'm a mutant. But I've got a condition called retinitis pigmentosa, where I've got a point mutation on one nucleotide on the rhodopsin gene, and it enables me not to recycle all the visual pigment. So over time, it's built up like freckles on your skin, and the vision sort of closes in, and a nice dirty mist comes in, and then eventually...
Can you see light and shade? What's the extent
light and
of
shade,
your vision?
Yeah. I can see the smile on your voice. Is about the best vision I've got. But as for seeing anything, no, it's all by feel now. So what you're looking at here, Sally, is a Husqvarna 2100 with an Alaskan mill that I made. So this is the latest tree we've milled. It's a walnut tree. And...
there it is.
Right, so we're at the back edge.
Out of the woodwork area, we rejoin the rope system.
And we've just rejiggled the ropes here, Sally, so this is your escape route should you to flee to your next apartment.
Graham's following the ropes with his... using your sticks as well at the same time. There's a lot going on in this series of circles, from composting to biodynamic preparations to building projects and vegetable plots.
So it's designed so this acts like a parabolic arc. So the morning sun hits here and bounces down. So each circle has a focus point of the sun. So this is a hexagonal garden. There are six paths. So if we go right around, it's a circle. But if we just walk over here, we should hit...
Yep, just right. There. We come to the vegetable garden with ropes and posts demarcating different areas. So this is,
we should find the central pole. So if you see now, there are six poles here. It's a hexagon, nine with a radius of 9 feet. The fire in the centre is 9 feet from each pole. So it's based on the bee, you know, the hexagon of the beehive. So basically, it's designed for a blind guy so he won't get lost in the garden. So from each pole here, with my cane I can touch two poles, so that's where the path is. And
part of the garden is set aside for a group of visually impaired people who are to be planting kumara and potatoes in about 6 weeks' time.
So this garden here is going to be the kumara garden, and for a few years now we've had a group of blind gardeners plant kumara and then come back and harvest them. So, developing a garden to show that, you know, no matter what your visual perception is, you can do anything. This is the one we've just dug. This is for potatoes. Now, we're going to put you to work over here on this garden. So we've just finished that one. And so here it is, Sally. This is the yuba.
It's sort of like a rake, but it's giant.
It's a big fork, yeah. I've just discovered...
You're expecting me to get in there and use that?
Well, demo first. Let me show you what it looks like.
So Graham's getting underneath. He's gone underneath the ropes, and you're...
Yeah, so this is my guide
at the helm of the broad fork. Graham has guide ropes and planks to help him while he's digging the bed.
Right, so what we do, Sally, is...
Yep. Doesn't wobble on you.
We have to get into a bit of acrobatics.
Graham's jumping on top of the broad fork.
Jiggling and wiggling to get it in.
And then pulling it back. Lifting the soil. Val's the weeder.
The collaborative concept is like a big chook. Yeah. Wherever I am, I know where I am. And in this garden design, because it's working on a crop rotation, that one there was for Kuruma's last year. Now this is the Kuruma garden. And so we did have chooks, so it would have been chooks, then potatoes, and then legumes, and then root crops.
The ropes help guide you to the garden as well as within the garden.
So let me see if it works. I've got to find my sticks again, Sally, because I put them down and lose them all the time. So this is past the compost heap.
Yep, that's right. That's the compost heap.
This is composted Tradescantia, Wandering Woolly. And people think it's a horrible weed, but it makes fantastic compost. Right, now we've got to be lucky, Sally, to get back to base camp soon. Let's see if we can do it. We should be able to get back to the hand basin. Once you've done your mahi, Sally, then you might be like me, a little bit grubby, so you can spruce up before we get back to civilization.
And that's where we join Ray, Brian and Val for a cuppa in the sun.
Because his eyesight has been so gradual, it's been a constant adaptation. So he hasn't had the shock of a sudden loss. So he's been able to modify, adapt, change, take on different challenges. And, you know, he's always looking forward now rather than harking back.
So this property is a demonstration of how he has adapted as the years have gone by.
Absolutely, yeah.
To me, it shows a very inventive mind.
Oh, it does. One of the scariest phrases in the English language for me is Graham saying, sitting there very quietly and then saying, I've just had a vision. And you think, oh my gosh, here's another huge project he's about to undergo. So sometimes it needs a little bit of reining in and refining.
So he's able to operate in this garden pretty much as before?
Yep. I trail around after him, make sure he doesn't sort of fall over things. But he's quite capable of moving around here on his own. Occasionally, he might get disoriented when he's up around the other side of the house, up in that big garden up the back. But he always has his phone with him, so I get a phone call saying, can you see me?
When's the next project?
Well, we won't know until I hear those immortal words, I've just had a vision.
Val Mosen. Graham's still running gardening workshops for blind people. And he's got one on coming up this week. And they'll be planting spuds this time, as the kumara haven't been so successful lately. Graham's also still keeping busy in his workshop.
Last Friday morning, Cosmo Kendish-Barnes was driving to Temuka to record a story for Country Life. Along the way, he stopped in at the Ashburton A&P show. Inside the gates, volunteer staff were zooming around on side-by-sides. The first few visitors were checking out high-tech ag machinery, and farmers were mingling as the first equestrian events got underway. In the middle of it all was a proud man with a big smile.
My name's Victor Shakur, and I'm the president of the Ashburton A&P Association, and we're here at the Ashburton Showgrounds.
Tell me a bit about the show here. How long has it been going?
Well, this is the 146th show, so 1877. I wasn't quite around in those days, but I've been going to shows for, or involved with, for 40-odd years, I suppose.
What's your background in the industry?
Well, I'm off a farm at Mount Summers, family farm. As a 17-year-old, I joined Wrightson NMA, and I'm still there 48, 49 years later with PGG Wrightson as a stock agent.
What kind of work is involved with being, you know, the president of this show?
Well, not a lot. It's just, it all revolves around the people around you. But no, it's, I say that in jest. A lot of it's chairing the meetings and just coordinating with a lot of people. Chris does a lot of that work too. He's our event manager. But everyone just pulls together. And like, we're just outside the HIP pavilion here, and you walk in there, there's about 40 or 50 ladies all with badges on, and they're all helping, which is great to see.
And how nice to have COVID out the way.
Definitely. Like, we had 2 years of no shows, no public shows. We had shows of a difference, show with a difference, and it worked okay, but we miss the people and the people that are our income.
So how do you become president? Do you get a tap on your shoulder?
Basically. I'd been involved with the AMP for 40-odd years just in the cattle section. In 2017, I thought, oh, I'll come along to the AGM. And I think people had me lined me up right from there, because we do struggle with people moving through the ranks. But we got the next 6 years covered, so that's good. We'll get a senior vice, junior vice, and someone else that wants to come in behind. So that's really good.
And it's all started today. What sort of things are happening?
Well, today is, there's a lot of judging done today. The horses started at 8 o'clock this morning. We've got the dog trials, which are going up in the top corner. They started yesterday due to the large number of entries, and that's going to revolve around the Trans-Tasman test, Australia versus New Zealand, on the main oval later on this afternoon, and finals tomorrow afternoon. Dog trialing has become very popular, and there's a lot of people competing in it, and it's good to watch, just the man and his dog.
There are a lot of stalls here.
There's a lot of stalls here, mainly trade sites, but we've got a craft area plus food stalls. We struggle a bit sometimes with numbers, but we're competing with other events, fates, and that around the country. But it's pretty good. All the food stalls are accommodated for and in full.
How important is this show for the local community?
Well, that's a wee bit personal, but I think it's very important. It's the rural urban connect. It's not everyone's cup of tea, but you just look out here. What you see, there's all the stalls. They like to see people, their clients coming in, generating a bit of business. And we've got a theme, which it revolves through the show. The theme this year is Let's Create a Buzz, Bees, Bugs and Butterflies.
And you've got Rude the Bug Man
coming.
Yes,
we have. He comes tomorrow. He's having shows in the President's Hive, which is just over here. Yeah, quite excited to meet him. He's a bit of a hard case, energetic, enthusiastic.
Why have you chosen that theme this year?
Well, I didn't choose it. My sister did. But I was going to go with something basic like e-farming or something, but she came up with this bees, bugs and butterflies. So it took me a while to get my head around it. But I can see where she's coming from. So it's covering the local gardener through to the cropping farmer and everything in between. And it revolves around the good bugs and bad bugs.
And that's a topic that will get children into the tent as well.
Well, we're trying to. My sister Julia, she's done a lot of work. She's got a wee questionnaire of fact-finding around the showgrounds. How many litres of milk is produced in Mid-Canterbury? How many whatevers, you know? She's got it all organised. Yes. It's to get people involved too.
And the weather's coming right?
Slowly. It was bitterly cold this morning, I can tell you that. But as I tell everyone, it can only get better.
How many people are you hoping to get through the doors today?
Oh, today is probably limited. There's a lot of school kids and a few farmers. They're big days tomorrow. Do we get 4,000 or 5,000, Chris? Something like that.
Yeah.
Now, Chris, what's your role here?
So I'm the show events convener, so I look after all the sort of logistics of the show and the trade area and entertainment and food and all that sort of stuff. So we've got a team of us that come here and help out, and we've been here since Monday afternoon helping set up and put all the stuff out. It's quite amazing how it all comes together. And then we've got our carnival on tonight, so first time we're opening up the sideshows from 5 till 9. So we just want to try and see how it goes and hopefully make it a regular thing. And there's a couple of food vans going to be there. And in the future, if it sort of works out, the hope is that we can grow it and we'll have a band and do all that on the Friday night. So it's just something else that we can offer the Mid-Canterbury community.
That's a great idea, because you might be able to attract some teenagers who might not come in the day.
Yep, and then hopefully they might decide, oh, well, you know, I really enjoyed it, I want to come back on Saturday, or, you know, the kids will come along on Friday night and they'll really enjoy it and they'll nag mum and dad that they want to go again on Saturday and they'll come back on Saturday. So Yeah, we're quite excited by it.
Yes, yes. And what do you do when you're not helping out here at the show?
So I'm actually a builder, so I go back to building. So this is quite a nice change from building, and it's a different group of people to talk to. And I've sort of come from parents were farmers, and my father was a president of the show, and I just enjoy talking to farmers and all that. So it's really good.
Yes. And Chris, is it a challenge getting people to volunteer nowadays?
It can be, but I don't know. I think the sort of farming community has been brought up and know that for things to happen, you've got to volunteer and help in and dig in and help out. So I think we're quite lucky from that point of view. And we've had quite a few new members onto the committee and onto the organisation helping us. So, yeah, it's really good. Mm.
And Victor, I guess you'll be spending the day shaking hands, chatting to people, seeing people you haven't seen for a while.
That's right. And that's where I see the show as too, as a connect with people just coming to the show and having a yarn and get off the farm.
What's your favourite part of the show?
Well, I enjoy the shearing. I always enjoy the physical work, but the skill that goes with it. Mm. But, I mean, all aspects I enjoy. Shearing, you could say, is favourite. We got calves tomorrow. That's always reasonably popular. Dog trials is good to watch for a while. The horses, you know, everything.
I'm Ben Stock. I'm vice president. I'm following Victor for the next show.
Are you a local farmer?
Yeah, we're just farming about half an hour out of town, and we're dairy farming down there, and so it's a new district for us. I have moved from another district to get here, and it's a good way of meeting a lot of new folk and getting amongst it.
Mm. How is farming going at the moment?
It's had a wee check, I suppose. The dairy side of things had a little bit of a check, and it's but look, I think it's shown a few signs of a bit of improvement, so it's great. You know, it's good.
And what's happening this week on farm?
We're in our first week of mating, so fortunately we've got some fantastic staff who can hold the front when I'm not there. And first week of mating, so cycling cows, tail paint, and then hopefully a few pregnant cows.
I'm Karen Tyne from Waimati, and I've come down, and this morning I competed in the coloured ring with some big horses, and as you can see I've got miniatures. And I'm just getting ready this afternoon to compete in the miniature ring.
So how many horses in total have you come with?
Competing three this weekend.
And these miniatures are gorgeous. How would you describe them?
They've each got their own little personalities.
Yes.
Some people can easily confuse them with Shetlands, actually, but they're a far finer type. They're about that size, but they're a far finer type. So this guy is a stallion who hasn't been out for 6 years. I've recently got him, so he's a bit of an unknown today. And the other guy, he competed in the coloured ring this morning and picked up a few ribbons.
When you compete, what do you do?
Similar to what they're doing out here, basically round in circles. But the judge may ask for an individual show as well.
Yes. And are you from a farm?
Yes, sheep and beef and horses.
What do you love about horses?
Ah, just, they've always been in my life. It's a hobby, really.
And do you compete regularly at AMP shows?
Yes. Not doing as many this year due to the cost of everything, but Ashburton is just, it's a case of I actually do Ashburton on my way north because I'll do Amberley show tomorrow.
You're on a road trip?
I do two on a wee road trip for the weekend. As a breeder, it's a way for me to get the stallions out for people to see them, to perhaps use them.
That was Karen Tyne at the Ashburton A&P show with her miniature horses. Cosmo was also talking to Ben Stock, Chris Watson and show president Victor Shakur.
My name is Woodsy. I'm the maker of Woodsy Rockers. I'm from Taranaki. You are listening to Country Life on RNZ National.
Next on Country Life, we're taking you back in time to the Second World War, when many women were left to farm on their own as their husbands and sons went to war. Rhoda McWannell was one of those women, and she kept a diary of her struggles and successes. Her great-niece, Alex Shepherd, has been combing through Rhoda's journals, and as Professor of Gender History at the University of Glasgow, she found them particularly fascinating. Here's a taste of Rhoda's wartime farming journals, read by actor Amy Tarleton.
They have no idea at home what it feels like to work at a great paddock of grass, ready to cut, and to know that you yourself have to lift and handle and stack every single blade of it. And then, in rain and wind, feed it all out again. Or what it feels like to start milking a cow and find a hard quarter, and then week after week henceforth to mess about with disinfectant in a separate cup in a separate bucket and disinfect your hands before you touch anything else and get rid of the filthy milk from that quarter and watch the other quarters go so that a cow worth £20 one week is only worth £2 the next.
She was quite twinkly. She was very short and she had her hair drawn up in a bun. She looked a bit like a pepper pot. She was generally smartly dressed. She wore a frock and a cardi, and she ate oatcakes for breakfast. My name is Alex Shepherd, and I'm a professor of gender history at the University of Glasgow. And Rhoda McWannell was my great aunt. I met her when I was 4. I was lucky enough to have my 4th birthday at Roselle, which was the farm that she and her husband Mac created in the Waikato. She was an amazing diarist, so her journals begin in 1938 and she kept up writing for 50 years. Yeah, she loved writing, clearly loved writing. She needed to write as often as she could.
Our first lamb was born yesterday. A bonny wee brown-faced one. I had begun to feel sure we would be depending only on dead wool for our income this year, so it was a ray of hope. We took the ewes for a browse this morning. Have taken them almost every day for weeks past. It is a lovely job on a fine day. Warm sun, and sweet dry bracken, and friendly fantails. It seems as if it must be good for them. It is so pleasant.
The most striking thing is just how hard she works. Her work is relentless. She's clearly a striver and she's a perfectionist. She has quite high standards, but she's a great commentator on farming in general and just how demanding that is, particularly actually of women's time.
I suppose that the experience I am having is common to farms all over the world at present. Not only on the side of the United Nations, but of enemy countries too. The neglected fields are unaware which side of the war their absent husbandmen are fighting on. And if it is like this here, what must it be like in countries that are actually devastated? This is the 6th lambing I have tackled without Mac. Amazing. It is an experience that does not fall to the lot of many women. I have really enjoyed this week, while the weather has been fine and things going well.
They have a very small dairy herd, which is mainly her responsibility. And then once the war gets underway, they sell the cows because Mac leaves the farm. He serves in the army initially at various camps, training troops, and then he's transferred to the Air Force and is involved in setting up the first bomber base in New Zealand for the Pacific War. So he's away for most of the war. He comes back occasionally on leave. And, you know, Rhoda takes over the management of the farm and they sell the cows and she's responsible for about 350 ewes and her hens and the garden and still all the housework, cooking. If there's ever any workers on the farm, then she's not just cooking for herself, but she's cooking for them. They're shifting sheep all the time. They're marching sheep up and down to keep them in good condition. They're, often she's working 18-hour days, sometimes even more. She describes her fatigue at times as well, and then she'll finally get to bed and then she can't sleep because all the worries are going round her head and about whether or not she can get rid of her produce or
The apples are thorough bastards. Nobody will have them. No, definitely not apples. The government has complete control of them. They are rationed. It is impossible for a humble grower like me to reach the government with my apples in any way. They will make good compost. And what use will the compost be? I could use it to grow more produce, to make more compost.
She can be very wry about all the small, crazy things about life that just don't add up. That things that seem super sensible and straightforward to her, and when she runs up against obstacles, she can be very funny as a way of criticising what she sees as general idiocy around her.
I have entered the black market. Lemons keep ripening. Every box I can find is full. We have wrapped up so many in newspaper that we use one day's paper before the next comes. Nobody wants them. I sent a case to Mary McWannell at a cost of 4 shillings 4 pence. And she goes crazy over them, says that in Christchurch they are unprocurable at any price, and these are the best we have ever sent. As we also have hundreds of pounds of perfect apples we cannot grapple with, I asked Anderson if he buys bundles. No. The demand is great and urgent, but he is forbidden by the government from buying local lemons. In disgust, I packed a basket of 5 dozen lemons, which I took into the co-op. I covered up this disgraceful secret with brown paper, slunk into the darkest corner of the shop and slid it over the counter, whispering my guilty admission to the man that these were lemons. He made me sign a form and handed me 7 and 6. I crept out, hoping nobody had noticed my transaction, and feeling that one might almost as well be a case of VD as have a bit of produce to sell. There has been so much warm rain that the whole farm is growing what Matt calls dynamite, to wit, lush, green, soft, eczematous grass.
There's no vet locally, so if there's any bearing trouble or anything like that, you know, she's in the front line for that. Although actually I think some of her medical training comes in handy there. She's not squeamish, you know, she will get stuck in.
This afternoon I put the ewes in number 6 and left them there over 2 hours because they'd been in there for about 5 days and I thought they would be safe for that time. But when I took them out, there was a fine young ewe down, writhing with the violent indigestion of bloat. Limbs stiff, eyes staring out of her head, breathing like a runaway steam engine and sides blown up tight as a drum. My heart failed me, not only at the sight of her suffering, but at the thought of having to tell Mac I'd lost another ewe, and also the knowledge that I must do something about it. I mixed a drench of baking soda and gave her that, and then felt for her ribs and chose the spot just below them, and with grim determination plunged the carving knife into her side. Well, I expected gas to come whistling out, but it didn't. It came bubbling slowly in some blood like a little pool of boiling mud at Rotorua. It smelt just like the overpowering smell of cow's breath. I kept the puncture open with the knife and held her so that her head was up and persevered like that for an hour or more, while gas kept bubbling out and her breathing became easier. Finally, she staggered to her feet and tottered away, looking okay as far as her face went and breathing normally, but very wonky in her gait. It was just dark then. I wonder if she'll be alive in the morning.
The one thing she really doesn't like doing is killing animals, but she's up for pretty much anything else. She writes about all of that and incredibly vividly. She writes about what it's like to do the milking and have eczema on her hands. And
my hands had got to the stage with milker's eczema that all the back of each thumb and every tiny division in the skin was cracking and beginning to bleed and so itchy I could tear them to ribbons and stinging furiously every time they got wet.
and acute cowpox inside my nose, so that I had to go to all the bother of breathing in and out all the time instead of not knowing I was breathing.
She writes about what it's like to dock lambs and, yeah, she's just full of vivid description.
It is miraculous having a dog that is eager and willing to work and so keen that he can see himself what is needed. After that idle fool of a Joe all these years, it really thrills me. Jock is so young that he is often in doubt and he looks at me, just waiting for a hint. And then off he goes, like an arrow. He just floats over fences or gates. He rounds up sheep with hardly any guidance, to and fro, keeping them all in place, and nips without actually biting and barks. The sheep, accustomed to Joe, of whom they take no atom of notice, don't know what the hell has struck them and they go bounding about at an incredible speed, so I often have to keep shouting, "Steady, steady!" I do not know the whistle to stop Jock, nor can I make him sit down. Anyway, it was sort of misty down there, and it took some time to get all the groups of sheep into one mob before opening the gate into the lane. I got them all up and was just about to put them in the yard when I saw Jock's attention wander. And there was Mac. He was amazed, having come to do the job and not knowing I could work the dog. He patted me on the back and said it was most impressive and I was a damned sight more capable than he thought I was.
You know, Rhoda had an idea for a book that she would love to have written, which was called Backline Soldiers. And it was about the unsung valour of women on the home front during the Second World War. I mean, Rhoda at the time would have been classified as a housewife and as a dependent, as a married woman. And her work wouldn't have counted or wouldn't have been seen to count. I think what's interesting is her writing shows just how vital her work was, not just to the war, but Mac depended heavily on her. There's no way that farm could have run without her. I think also seeing her growing confidence and independence during the Second World War, lots of women whose husbands were away found and learned all sorts of new skills and a greater sense of autonomy. And I think it was a really interesting time for gender relations. She really knew what was going on from several sources. So she read the papers voraciously. She listened to the news. She has the radio on constantly and quite often records the BBC bulletins from Daventry.
This is the BBC Home Service. And here is a special bulletin read by John Snag. D-Day has come. Early this morning, the Allies began the assault on the northwestern face of Hitler's European fortress.
In fact, there's a lovely entry when she talks about walking around her kitchen trying to speak in English received pronunciation like they do on the BBC. So she's imitating the accent she hears on the radio. And of course, because Mac is serving first with the army and then with the Air Force, she gets all the military gossip from him. So she records quite a bit about petty squabbles happening at camp or whether or not Mac thinks New Zealand troops are ready, especially after the Japanese enter the war and there's a real fear in 1942 of possible invasion. It's interesting because on the one hand, she's really aware of what's going on globally, you know, where the action is, when ships have been sunk or where battles are taking place, what kind of losses are happening. And then she feels the incongruity of how her life is relatively peaceful.
The other morning, Jock vanished. In consternation, I whistled and whistled and whistled.
As time went by and further piercing and prolonged whistling produced no sign of him, I began to view the matter as a calamity of international importance. He is not in the habit of disappearing, and the poor darling has no road sense whatever, so I was oppressed with horrid forebodings for his safety. Furthermore, I was in urgent need of him to shift sheep at once, because otherwise I visualised myself spending the rest of the day treating bloat, which I had no desire to do, or alternately digging graves, which prospect was dismaying to a degree. I prowled uneasily about, whistling my loudest, and thinking that obviously I cannot manage for even half a day without Jock. If he is lost, I shall have to get Mac to return to the farm. Awful pictures in my mind of me and Mac running blasphemously round and round barking at ewes. And then I thought that, incompetent as the army is now, without Mac it will fail utterly. Chaos will reign, and the collapse of the New Zealand forces will result in a speedy and glorious victory for Hitler. And then quietly, and without haste, I saw Jock wriggle through his hole in the fence and come ambling towards me. I was so profoundly thankful to see him that I forbore to give him the thrashing he so richly deserved, but I did explain to him that he must not again jeopardise the Allied cause and the British Empire in that light-hearted manner.
She'll say something like, how odd it feels to turn on the radio and hear news of the latest round of losses, and then think, ah, it must be time for toast. You know, that she's just getting on with her daily life. But then at the same time, her daily life, she starts seeing in these sorts of military terms. So, you know, her sheepdog Jock now is part of the imperial forces. And when mice get in the hen feed, she talks about bringing in the Panzer Division to try and eliminate them. And so she uses a lot of the rhetoric of the day.
So lovely, walking on the crisp sand and watching the ewes enjoying themselves and looking over the hills at the heavenly blue distances and green pastures. I was listening to all the nice little sounds as if the world was gently purring. It was so quiet and the warm sun on my back felt like a caress. The patter of the ewes' feet on the sand made just the same noise as tiny waves on a beach. The birds were all about in the hedges, winging to and fro, not singing, but there was a constant twittering and cooing going on all about. In the distance a dog barked and a train whistled. I walk in front with a stick and Hoppy walks behind with Jock. The ewes trot along up the banks and into the brambles and nose among the long grass for tasty morsels. After all the rain, it is grand to get out of the mud onto the firm sand and change from mushy grass to lovely crunchy dry grass and bracken. I thought, watching them, they are exactly like us civilians in wartime, with Churchill in front to lead us and Hitler behind to bite us. And what each one makes of the journey depends entirely on individual initiative and enterprise. The extraordinary thing is that, having got this far, I would much rather carry on and finish the job myself than hand it over. I am exceedingly proud of my war effort.
Rhoda McWannell, farmer, writer and painter, brought to life by actor Amy Tarleton. You also heard from Rhoda's great-niece, Professor Alex Shepherd, on the phone to me from Glasgow. The diaries are now with the Alexander Turnbull Library, and we'll put some links on our webpage. Alex hopes to put out an edition of Rhoda's wartime diaries and, longer term, an online account of her life and times.
Now, next week, we meet Fraser Ross, who's been looking after Aru Whenua Bush near Temuka for nearly 50 years. It looked more like a battlefield when he first set eyes on it following a huge 1975 storm that knocked over many of its mature trees. Find out more about the restoration project next week on Country Life.
Well, that's all we've got time for. Thanks so much for joining us. Do send us your feedback to country@rnz.co.nz. We love hearing from you, especially if you have ideas for stories.
Ka kite anō.
Bye now.
Softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.